You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Here's a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Many people are hitting the road or catching a flight this next week as they travel to reunite with family or other loved ones. We thought today we'd invite a few dads on to talk about the challenges of traveling with kids and share their stories and advice for everyone. Matt Barresi and Todd Jay are two of the hosts of the comedy podcast, The Paternity Test, and they're on the line with us now from Chicago and Montgomery, Illinois. Hey, Matt, Jay, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Matt,
thanks for having us.
Yeah, Matt, let's start with you and welcome back to the 21st. You were on recently to talk about bathrooms and the challenges of bathrooms with kids. I feel like this is an even bigger category, right? Because you have a 5-year-old daughter, but traveling involves not just being, say, a dad with a little girl in a bathroom, but a whole host of other challenges. Where have you gone with your daughter?
Well, we took our first flight in January of this year when she was 4, and it was to Orlando, to Disney World. And it,
how'd that
I
go?
Call it poorly. It went poorly.
It went poorly. Okay. In what way did it go poorly?
She, and you know the difference, I think, between this and the horrors of taking your little girl to a public bathroom is that the problem is only your own in the public bathroom, but you have an audience of a couple of hundred people on an airplane, a hostile audience. And, the trip back was fine. I think she was worn out and sated from Disney magic, but the trip there, her first flight, takeoff was lovely and delightful and full of squeals of excitement. And then she became just a rage monster, I think, from the pressure change in her ears and being cooped up on the plane. So she was just every bit the disaster that you would
Here's always the question, right? Did you I would think that lots of parents are nervous about this and they plan, and I wonder if you can share what you planned and then how maybe all of that probably fell apart if she just was, you know, not cooperating, right?
Sure. Well, you know, when you look at when people discuss what to do with kids while traveling, I think there are three categories of plans, and they are ranging from in least to most efficacy and from least to most stridency. They are describe, distract, and dose. And by describe, I mean tell your kid what to expect so that they will be invested and excited and not frightened. And so we did that, but you know, depending on the age of your kid, if your kid is from between 1 and 5, they're really not a particularly rational animal. So that worked on takeoff because she wanted to see a plane take off. Distract is probably the moderate view, what most people are going to do, and probably the best thing you can do. And we brought an iPad, but it just wasn't enough. All the apps in the world didn't keep her occupied for the entire flight, nor did it overpower the bubble in her ears. And then the last one, dose, is to give your child Benadryl, which we don't subscribe to. It's probably the most effective thing, but it seems
just
a little
to drug your kid, in other words,
and potentially dangerous. Yeah. So we told her what the flight was going to be.
Go ahead, Todd. Yeah.
I would not judge a parent who decided that was their going to be their best option. So I'll say, as a word of warning, if you're planning on having that as an option, try it at home first, because there is a side effect, a potential side effect, with a percentage of all of
could make them really hyper, right?
The paradoxical effect, where it can have the reverse effect, and then you're trapped in an aluminum tube, you know, with a kid who is uncontrollable and loud and you know, uncontrollable. So do try it at home if you think that might be an option for you, an hour before bedtime, see what happens, and then you know whether or not that might be an option for you on a plane. Don't have it just and decide to do it on the fly.
That's good advice. Okay, so everyone who's listening can join the conversation. You can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to us, 21STShow, to share your experience of traveling with kids. If you don't have kids and you want to share your experience as well, that's fine too. Matt, you said there was a hostile audience on the plane. I fly all the time, and I don't have children. I have lots of nieces and nephews, so I'm always sort of the interested observer in all of this. And I think because I fly all the time, I have maybe a different perspective, but when you say hostile audience, were people really hostile, like they were articulating their hostility to you, or were they just glaring at you, which is, I guess, also articulating it?
Well, I've been, I think before having a child, I was a hostile flyer. Like when a child would have a tantrum on a plane, I would judge that parent. I would even say things like, what can you do about that child? So it's karmic that my daughter is a terrible traveler now.
Okay.
Because I realized that, you know, there's no ethical ground that you can stand on to say that children should not be allowed to fly. And there's no way to really control them on a flight within reason. So I think that people, and I understand they're business traveling, they may be traveling, they might be stressed out, but there's no reason to be mean to parents when their kids are having a tantrum.
Were people mean to you when she was...
Well, I think the real secret to flying with children is always fly to Orlando and only fly to Orlando.
Because was the whole plane full of kids having meltdowns?
And all of them. Everyone was melting down. Everyone was tiny. So no one was judging because it was a comically disastrous flight.
Well, and Todd, let me ask you this. Todd, your kids are older, 11 and 14, but I've never actually seen this happen, but I have heard of stories. One of my producers and I, we were talking about this, parents who get on a plane and they pass out like notes or earplugs or say like, sorry in advance if I cry, like a note written by the baby ostensibly. Do you think that's a way to go? I think earplugs, my position on this is I think if you are a traveler, I always carry earplugs with me. I'm always prepared. I just put them in as soon as I get on a plane. I don't care if I'm sitting next to a baby or someone who's not going to cry. Mm-hmm. I just don't. Wouldn't hear anyone, but
well, I feel like the preemptive apology goodie bag kind of set. You know, I feel like you're setting yourself up to say to tell the people around you,
my child isn't going to behave, right?
I'm planning on my child being a monster, so you're just going to have to deal with it. Here's a fun sized Twix to get you through it. So I'm not a fan of those. I feel like what's more effective is to, as long as people see that you are engaged and trying and doing your best and not just giving up or not just, you know, trying to pay attention to your phone or magazine and letting your child kick the seat in front of you, I think if they see that you have a very genuine effort and you've had a plan and you're trying your best, they're less likely to judge you and you know, maybe they'll even be more apt to assist. I mean, I'm one who, if I'm sitting across from a child, I'm all for distracting them, making faces. If it's a small child, if I can engage them for a couple of minutes, that might be the 2 minutes that parent needs to kind of reset and reboot, you know, and that short little break might get them ready to have another activity ready for their child. So if I'm there and I can be useful, I will be. I'm not going to.
Okay, so here's my question about that, right? Because I think it's different for me because I'm a woman, but I feel like some people might be nervous about engaging a stranger's kid, right? And I feel like, do you have to ask the parent? Is it just a question of you say hi to the parent when they sit down with the kids so they know that you're not hostile? If you're someone who doesn't have kids, because I think there probably are people who would want to, and I think this is a generational thing too, because I feel like a lot of older people feel like they don't have these boundaries and they'll just play with someone else's kid. But I feel like if you're younger, you might be a little more nervous about that. So what would you suggest would be a respectful way for someone who doesn't have kids to like interact with your kid on a plane?
Well, I think if you say hi to them when they first get on, maybe ask a question about the child, how old, you know, what's their favorite thing, you know, something like that. But then, you know, the interactions, obviously, that you want to be careful about. You don't necessarily want to be touching or grabbing or anything like that, but if you can be making silly faces across the aisle, and if you can kind of read you know, how the parent feels about it, and if you want to ask permission, if you can interact with them, that's fine too. But I just feel like that initial interaction before things get started, just by saying hi and having a nice friendly greeting, kind of lets them know, hey, I'm on your side.
Right. And then, so let's go back to the describing. Matt, can you talk about that? What sort of, like, you think for people who haven't flown, what's in the description phase if you're going to go from maybe under 5 years old? What kind of things do you say? How do you prepare a kid for, we're getting on a plane, we're going on a plane for the first time, we're going to the airport, those sorts of things?
Sure. Well, probably they're excited about the notion of flying because airplanes are part of every children's book and cartoon, and so they understand that planes fly and that people are on them, so they're probably already there. What they probably don't understand is that there's other people on the plane, that they're going to be on it for a while, that they're not going to understand about the discomfort in their ears. And when the plane actually starts to take off, I think they may find that it's a little more thrilling or alarming than they had anticipated as far as being tipped back and moving quickly. So to describe all those things and do it repeatedly, because these are teeny little brains and they're trying to work things out. So for, you know, months ahead of the flight, if you know you're going to take a flight, to keep revisiting the idea of the flight and walking them through the steps, getting them to tell you what they know is going to happen on the flight so that they understand and can be excited about it, is going to help them from anything you can turn down the emotional temperature on the flight, because you're nervous, they're nervous, the people around you are nervous, and you're just trying to stop conflict from happening or stop a match being struck.
Right.
And don't forget to include the pre-flight descriptions as well, because you got to talk to them about standing in line, about
going security lines,
security, and how you're going to describe that, because they're going to see a lot of people in uniforms with, you know, holsters and people getting scanned. And so you want to make sure that you describe that process also, because that can be a scary thing as you're, you know, a smaller child surrounded by adults in this line moving slowly. So be sure you're including all that pre-flight business with them as well when you're talking about it.
Let me ask you guys a question about that, especially pre-flight. We were talking about this morning in the office. I feel like, and I've had family members who have lost children at the airport, so I feel like this is in the context of that. I feel like you never see the leashes on kids anymore at airports. I feel like that's not a thing. Or do people not do that anymore? Or how do you kind of, and that's part of, frankly, the anxiety of any family traveling, is you're worried about losing your kid or kid not keeping up. There's a lot of people around. There are a lot of strangers. How do you kind of handle that, especially if they're little?
That's an excellent question.
Well, I was never a leash.
You not only have the children, you have bags.
Right, right. Yeah. You have bags and a child, right.
Mm-hmm.
Matt, were you saying that you have never been a leash person?
Oh, no, we had a leash. We
you did have a leash. Okay.
Yeah, but children are getting stronger, I think. It's the hormones in the
They're getting stronger. Okay,
we had a very small window where the leash worked for our child, because she caught on to the fact that she was on a leash, and that was that.
So
I don't know if leashes just didn't work as well as people hoped they would, or if it's just become a social stigma to have your child on a leash. But I don't see the leashes anymore either.
Oh, so you think maybe it's a social stigma. Todd, we're back. Do you think there's a social stigma now? You can't put a leash on your child anymore? Is that what it is?
I think it does look, it looks like you're taking the easy way out. Like, I'm just going to tie the child up, and then no matter what, I can pay attention to anything else. I do think there's a stigma to it. As soon as you say the word leash, you know, a child on a leash, it just sounds...
Right. There's probably another name for it, but that's what I call it. I don't know what the name is. Maybe they call it, like, child harness or something like that, but...
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've got a couple minutes before we have to take a break. I wanted to ask you, move to the second part about distraction and what tips you guys have for, especially for a plane, but then I think this also applies to a car travel. What kind of tools do you have for, by the way, my producers are telling me the official term is child safety harness, even though no one uses that, right? Yeah, okay. What kind of tools do you have for distracting, apart from an iPad?
My biggest tip about distraction is to have distractions that you can space out. So it might be something that you maybe go to the dollar store and find a number of things that you don't let your child pick out, because as soon as they know that they're available, they're going to want all of them at the same time in quick succession. So I'm a big proponent of having things ready, you know, that you can pull out as soon as you see the tide starting to turn, and maybe it's something new. You know, children love the cheap toys, you know, it's something you can get at a dollar store that you could even throw away after the trip is over. But if you want to space that stuff out, don't let them know everything that you have with you, so that you can always kind of give them a surprise. And so the other thing about things to do on travel and plane, I'm also a big fan of what I would call the clean crafts. So things like the Color Wonder markers that only write on the paper that you have, or the Magna Doodle, so they can do a craft without making a big mess or drawing on somebody's suitcase or anything like that.
Right, right. That's good. Clean crafts, spacing it out. Matt, how about you?
Well, and this is where we went wrong. We went right to our best option.
Your fail-safe right away. Okay.
Yeah, and that was a huge mistake, because if a fully animated, you know, cartoon episode of Duck McStuffins doesn't do the trick, you can't go back. You can't say, how about a craft? Like, it's done. And you barely left the runway. So we needed more of those small things, and we needed to lay them out in some kind of order. Because really, I think you want your last thing to be diving into a cartoon. And I think that it is important to not die on the hill of your house rules as far as screen time or sitting still. Like, you know, it's a new experience. It's a scary experience. It's a lot of waiting. And, you know, for an adult, when you're bored at the airport, you get work done, or you noodle on your phone, or you read, or you...
Matt, let me stop you there. We're just going to take a break. But when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Matt and Todd, co-hosts of the Paternity Test podcast. Stay tuned to this encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. My guests are Matt Barresi and Todd Jay. They're co-hosts of the comedy podcast, The Paternity Test, to Chicago, Montgomery, Illinois dads who've been talking to us about traveling during the holiday season. Matt, you were talking before the break about rules and parents and kind of maybe being a little more lenient about the rules. And I want to throw another thing out there for everybody. News this morning that some airport workers at O'Hare have voted to authorize a possible strike. So there may be a strike next week at O'Hare. The timing of that is not clear. It's some airport workers. It's all sort of very up in the air now. But I was just thinking that could possibly be in the works next week. There's always travel delays. You know, Wednesday is the busiest travel day of the year in this country. So I guess it's a good reminder maybe about being prepared for delays, but also kind of being flexible about rules. What do you think, Matt?
Well, that's the thing is travel is on a good day, travel is very boring. I mean, maybe not, you know, driving past scenes you've never seen, but like there's a lot of hurry up and wait in travel. And for an adult, that can be fine because we have an interior life and we can meditate on our failings or whatever we do when we have a lot of time to ourselves. But a child has no memories, has no work to think about, and they're very, very bored, and perhaps they should be. So if you have screen time limits, or you wouldn't normally give them a bag of new toys, or you wouldn't normally, I don't know, run up and down the hallway of the concourse of the airport, I think you need to be a little more lenient for their sake when you're in these really stultifying scenarios.
Mm-hmm. Todd, what about you? I mean, when we're thinking also, we've been talking a lot about air travel. A lot of people are going to be driving, especially Thanksgiving. Lots of people are driving across the Midwest, across the country to visit family. Your kids are older, so they're 11 and 14. Is it a lot easier now when they're older? You're just kind of with their devices plugged in with their own headphones or whatever in the car, or how do you handle that?
It has gotten easier in that way, in that they are a little more distracted with their own devices and they can entertain themselves a little more. But you do get a lot more of the, you know, are we there yet? I need to stop for the bathroom. Even as much as with smaller children. I think with smaller children, you can kind of regiment them a little bit more in some of that and some of those stops. But we started driving. We drove once a year for the last 13 years from here to Florida. So we've made that trip with our children as infants, as toddlers, and every age, you know, from there. And we've tried a couple of different methods. We've tried the overnight drive, you know.
Right, yeah, because it's about 20 hours, depending on where you're going in Florida. That's a long drive.
Sure, so we've driven straight through when we were young and full of energy and thought we could do that. And that was semi-successful. The thing I will say about that, if you're trying any kind of nighttime driving where you expect your child to sleep, make sure that you're leaving. You know, when you leave your destination, you've got a full tank of gas and an empty bladder, because you don't want to get an hour in after they fall asleep and realize, oh, we got to stop for gas or I need to use the restroom. Because as soon as you stop that car, that motion, the stopping of the car motion is likely to wake them up, or you're opening the door. And once they're up, they tend not to fall back asleep. So if you want to get a chunk of driving done while they're sleeping, be prepared and be prepared to not stop. and get as much as you can. If you can get 300 miles without stopping while they're sleeping, that's a big win right there.
That's a good point. When kids are older, I mean, I feel like we've spent a lot of time talking about sort of negative things about travel, but I wonder if either of you have great stories or good stories you want to share about travel, or just encouragement that you want to offer people who are nervous about it.
Well, I'd say, you know what, be open about, to the delays. And be ready to kind of do something out of the ordinary. So if you wouldn't normally stop and have McDonald's for lunch, but you find one that has, say, an indoor playland, and maybe the weather's not great and you're in a long drive, give them that extra 20 minutes or so to get some energy out and play. We found that a lot of rest stops now while we're driving on longer trips have some playgrounds, and we've done it ourselves where we've decided to we'll bring a ball and something and we'll play with them. And the kids love that, and it breaks up the drive. They get some time with you guys in an unusual place. You play a couple of games. It might mean that your drive, you might get to your destination a half hour later, but they're fun moments, and it makes the drive better for the kids.
Yeah, thanks for that, Todd. Matt?
We love to share music with one another when we're traveling because it's time, it's kind of wound down time with just the family, whether we're sitting in the airport or driving in a car. And, you know, if you live in Illinois, there's a lot of driving. It's a big state with a lot of expanses. So whether it's with headphone splitters or in the car, we have a deal where we'll trade back and forth, a grown-up song, one of Viva's songs. And so if she wants to hear some kid music that she likes, she can, but then she'll get introduced to our music. So she'll, you know, all of us like the Beatles. Everybody likes the Beatles. So it's a chance to, you know, if you're a music buff, if you're in a music or education, it's a chance to work on harmony and learn about it. But it's also a chance for them to learn, get a bigger musical palette, and then for them to tell you what music they like.
I guess you can work on harmony in a car. Have you ever done that in an airport, Matt?
I can't say I would rule it out.
Last question. Are either of you guys traveling for the holidays?
We're lucky enough to get to stay home this year. We've done our share of traveling, and now we've started to invite the family this way. So but we are flying to California over Christmas, and that's going to be a new thing for us is Christmas travel. So I haven't done that before.
We'll be driving from the north side of Chicago to Coal City, Illinois, south of I-80. So that's 80 minutes on a good day on Thanksgiving. We could imagine we'll get the whole White Album and Revolver and Abbey Road in.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks so much. Have a great Thanksgiving. Thanks to Matt Barresi and Todd Jay. You can catch their comedy podcast. It's called The Paternity Test, available wherever you can find podcasts. Thanks, guys. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Hunting season is in full swing all throughout Illinois, but fewer Canadian geese are finding their way to southern Illinois in recent years. Experts say part of the reason might be because of climate change. In a few minutes, we're going to talk about that with a representative from the National Wildlife Federation. But first, we spoke with Dale Beatley, a co-owner and president of Gander Hill Hunting Club in southern Illinois near Pinckneyville, about how important goose hunting is to the economy and culture for many families in southern Illinois.
It's a sport like baseball or basketball. I mean, it's something that people pass on to their kids if they've did it. If you golf or something, you know, what do you teach your children how to do? You teach them how to golf, you know, because that's something you've always did and you've enjoyed.
Dale also shared with us a little bit of his slow cooker recipe for how he cooks geese he's hunted.
I use some apples in a crock pot. I put about 8 breast pieces in there for about 6 hours and with some seasoning. Then it crumbles, and I make it into barbecue. The apple takes the wild taste out of just about anything, you know, game-wise. It, you know, puts a sweet taste into it.
Dale's been hunting his entire life since he was a boy, but what he's noticed in recent years, compared to when he hunted in the 70s and 80s, is that there's been a consistent decline in the number of Canadian geese reaching southern Illinois, and he thinks climate change might be to blame.
There's clubs all through the southern Illinois here, and they're hunting clubs to where basically Canadian geese had been the big draw to get everyone to come to southern Illinois, and now, I mean, there's people come and they still hunt. They hunt a few geese and we shoot some speckled belly geese. and they shoot ducks and snow geese. But Canadians, is just due to the weather and the warmer winters, has found that they don't have to come to Southern Illinois.
That's Dale Beatley. He's co-owner and president of Gander Hill Hunting Club near Pinckneyville in Southern Illinois. We wanted to explore a little bit more about what Dale said about migrating birds and climate change. That's why we're joined now by Frank Selassie from the National Wildlife Federation. He's the manager of Great Lakes Regional Campaigns. Frank, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You know, we just heard Dale mention he suspects climate change is the reason there just aren't as many Canadian geese migrating down to Southern Illinois. Is he right about that?
Well, climate change is certainly a contributor to the stress that Canadian geese and other species are facing from human impacts, whether it's from fragmentation of landscapes, pollution, urbanization. Climate is a risk multiplier, and it is staying warmer longer not just Illinois, but also up in Canada.
What do you mean when you say risk multiplier? What do you mean by that?
Sure. Well, migratory birds rely on habitat, in order to reproduce and survive and travel. In the prairie pothole region, which includes the Great Plains, in southern Illinois, there's been a loss of wetlands and habitat. That's what we call fragmentation. And so for the habitat that's left, it's more susceptible to changes that come from climate change, such as increasing episodes of very heavy rainfall creates erosion and degrades the habitat for these waterfowl and game birds.
And Frank, when you're saying also, mm-hmm. when I'm thinking about that, when you're saying like a decrease in wetlands, a decrease in mm-hmm. habitat, is that because of our building, because of construction, human construction, or why are we seeing that?
Absolutely. I mean, you're seeing changes in agriculture, suburbanization, that type of development fragments wetlands, not just Illinois, but many places around the Great Lakes and the Great Plains have seen a loss in wetlands. And so climate aggravates that situation by making the habitat that's left even more treacherous for migratory waterfowl and game species. It's true not just in Illinois, but also in Canada. The Canadian boreal forests are only really 20% protected up there. What we've seen is because of increasing temperatures and increasing very heavy rainfall, some species of game birds up there have been cut in half.
Wow. So we are seeing decline in overall population for different waterfowl, then it sounds like you're saying, different waterfowl.
That's correct.
Uh-huh. And then are there other reasons also that are leading to decline in the population? Is it a possibility in terms of when we're talking particularly about fewer geese reaching Southern Illinois, is overhunting a concern? What other things are you seeing?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't call overhunting a concern. I mean, National Wildlife Federation has represented generations of hunters and anglers and wildlife enthusiasts. So we got our start in the 1930s and are comprised of, hunting clubs, gun clubs, fishing clubs all over the country. What we're seeing is an impact of climate change on game species really across the country. One of the other examples of climate impacting and adding stress to these game species is that the very heavy rainfall and the changing temperature conditions allows for invasive species that push out such things as smartweed and millets, which are food sources for ducks in the remaining wetlands. And so, not only is their habitat disrupted, but some of their food sources are being pushed out as well.
And, you know, Frank, as you said, you all, the National Wildlife Federation, you know, has represented and worked with hunting clubs across the country. I'm wondering, we've been talking about the environmental effects, or I guess maybe the environmental causes of geese and the population. But I wonder, you know, we heard Dale a little bit of his story from Pinckneyville, how much of, he's saying how much it's part of his culture and his family traditions to do this. I mean, what impact are you seeing in different communities across the country who I imagine are experiencing, it's not just Pinckneyville, like we're seeing this in different communities across the country. What kind of impact are we seeing?
Sure. Well, we certainly respect the tradition of, you know, passing on hunting and sportsmen's traditions to children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. It's a great heritage and one that, you know, we pledge to defend. Like you said, it's not just Southern Illinois and the Great North Woods of Minnesota, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and New England. We're seeing the warmer winters allowing pests such as ticks to live and survive these warmer winters, which are devastating young moose. There's been a dramatic decline in the moose population across the Great North Woods. It's resulted in the cancellation of moose hunts and candidly just a great concern about the future of that species going forward. What else you're seeing in you know, northern states is the diminishment of opportunities to ice fish.
Right, so those are right, not just cultural, I imagine, but economic impacts as we're thinking about
huge
tourism.
Economic impacts.
Yeah.
I mean,
so, Frank, to that point, we just have about a minute left, and I just want to ask what you think can be done. I mean, what would you like to see done to protect geese, other waterfowl? Where are we at with that?
Sure. Well, on the mitigation side, you know, we would like to see, and we continue to call on federal policymakers and state policymakers and businesses and citizens act on climate change. You know, the transition to clean, renewable, sustainable forms of energy is something that folks should embrace. And for communities that are impacted by that transition away from fossil fuels, there should be support for that transition. We also believe in support adaptation and resilience training for wildlife managers so that they can factor in the impacts of climate change on, professional wildlife management in state DNRs and other types of, management agencies.
Yeah, thanks for that, Frank. Sounds like lots of things to be done with this. So I want to thank Frank Selassie with the National Wildlife Federation, manager of Great Lakes Regional Campaigns. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. Stay tuned to hear more of this encore edition of the show. Coming up, we'll have more stories and news from across Illinois. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. If you have a dog, do you wonder whether he understands what you're saying? You may have seen the headlines recently saying your dog understands not just your tone, but also your words. That's according to a new study. We're joined now by veterinary behaviorist from the University of Illinois. Dr. Kelly Ballantyne joins us on the line from Chicago. Dr. Ballantyne, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do we know about how much dogs understand what people are saying to them?
Well, based on the results of that new study that was just published, what they determined was that the dogs could process both the words and the tone of our voice, and they could do so independently. And then they also kind of combined the two, so they can combine word and tone. So like when the experimenters were using praising words with praising tones of voice, that had the strongest effect, at least in the dog's brain reward centers. So that was a pretty neat finding.
Well, and it's also a little conventional, contradictory to conventional wisdom, right? Because I think we tend to think when you talk to an animal, especially a dog, if you're using the right tone, that's all that matters. But how did they actually figure out that words make a difference?
So, well, their study design was really interesting. So they used a couple of different conditions. So they had praise words with a praising tone of voice, and then they had praise words in a neutral tone of voice. And then they used the neutral words with that praising tone, and then just the neutral words with the neutral tone. And the dogs were, their brains definitely responded more to the praising words, which were probably words that they were really familiar with when given that praising tone of voice. And even like when they used the neutral words with a praising tone of voice, the dogs' brains did not respond as strongly.
Dr. Ballantyne, I'm probably going to offend some dog owners here, but I noticed that the dogs in the study were, to my mind, pretty intelligent dogs because there were border collies and German shepherds. They're dogs that we know that have been well-trained to interact with humans. And to, does it matter? Do different breeds have different levels of, I'm not going to say intelligence, but maybe vocabulary comprehension?
I don't know that we know the answer to that. We've bred dogs for different work, right? So like, as you mentioned, retrievers are really bred to pay attention to their handlers, whereas, you know, the hounds are really bred to go out and act independently. So that might look like their intelligence is different. You know, hounds are often considered to be stubborn or maybe not that smart, but it's possible that that's just, they just think about things differently.
Right. So do we think that it's actually, it isn't just your intonations, it is the actual words that matter in the sense that there are certain words the dogs really can understand?
Well, I really think it probably also really depends on the dog's experience. So if you're using, you know, the same word in the same context, I think a lot of dogs will pick up or at least, guess the meaning of what that word means. But if you're using random words all the time, it might be hard for them to learn what we're saying.
How do you think this new study builds on our previous understanding about how dogs do you actually process human languages?
Yeah, so I think a lot of the other studies have investigated the tone that we use, and we know that our tone of speech does definitely affect the dog's behavior, and specifically when we're using really strong emotions. So if we're really happy or we're angry, they tend to pick up on that a lot better than if we're just using a neutral tone of voice. And then we also know that dogs can learn, you know, the name of an object by even just watching two humans talking about an object in conversation. But in that study or in that kind of line of investigation, what they thought was probably happening was that the dog was picking up on the other cues that the humans were using, like looking at the object a lot, and they did a lot better if the people were looking at the object while also talking about it.
Well, and it was interesting. I was having a conversation with a friend about this recently, about how they speak to their dog in different languages. Does that make a difference? Does language matter to dogs? Or is it just, again, they're sort of picking up the contextual clues as well as the words, and it doesn't really matter what language it's in?
Yeah, so I think the context is really what's most important. And certainly, like, we also have a lot of clients where they will teach their dog specific cues in a different language. And I think as long as you're using the consistent word, the dog will be able to pick up on what the owner means. So language doesn't necessarily matter. I think it's more of the consistency.
And when we think about pet owners who want to increase their dog's vocabulary, what's the best way to do that? Is it constant training and repetition and being clear about the context?
Yes, that is certainly very, very helpful in teaching dogs what words mean, or at least what we're trying to imply that they mean. I think one of the situations that a lot of dog owners run into is they will use the same word in different contexts, and the best example I can get is, come when called. And so owners will say, come, and sometimes come means you come over here and I give you a treat or I give you some affection, and then sometimes come means you come over here and I take you away from the dog park, or you come over here and, I bring you into the bathroom and give you a bath. So I think if you want a consistent response from the dog, you want to use it in a very consistent context and always have a desirable consequence for that as well.
Dr. Ballantyne, in the study, the authors made a distinction between processing language and understanding it. What's the difference, right, do you think, for you, especially as we're thinking about dogs or other animals, and processing versus understanding language?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Understanding really implies, at least to me, comprehension of what the word means. Whereas processing language means their brains were responding to specific words. So their brains, you know, lit up when the familiar words were used, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they understood that, you know, the praising the good boy meant that they know that the meaning of the words good and boy.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be similar to, like, I guess the best example I could give is that, you know, if you're in a foreign country and you're hearing a language that you've never heard before, you might start picking up certain words that have been repeated and you can recognize those words, but you don't necessarily know what those words mean.
Right. And so when some people say, for example, that dogs have a comparable vocabulary to a human toddler, is that accurate?
Well, there have been a couple of studies, and, you know, they were both with border collies, where those dogs seem to have very extensive vocabularies. You know, one dog, he could recognize at least 200 different words and identify, or he chose the correct object when given the word, the name of that object. There was another study with another border collie where that dog seemed to understand over 1,000 words.
Mm.
So they learned the names for specific objects, but I still think that that's different than actually understanding language.
And where do dogs rank compared to, say, cats or birds when it comes to processing language?
Oh, well, I mean, I think that birds are really well known for processing or recognizing human words, like the bird Alex. There have been a lot of studies about. He was also able to identify specific named objects. I don't believe that there's been any work on cats and how good they are at identifying named objects. I have a feeling if they were trained to do so, that they would be, that they could do it.
Right. Well,
I don't know how they would compare.
Right. Well, you'd have to train the cat. And it was so interesting in the study, right, because they trained the dogs to lie quietly in an MRI machine and not move. I don't know if you could do that with cats.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if anybody has tried yet.
Dr. Ballantyne, we've been talking about how humans communicate with dogs, but what we haven't talked about is if humans are good at understanding dog communication. What do you think about that?
You know, communication is not just a one-way street. And I really feel like, you know, we focus a lot on how much dogs understand about us, but then I think we miss really trying to understand what dogs are trying to tell us with their, not only with their barks, but also with their body language. While we're good at identifying, like, big signals of concern, such as growling, snapping, or biting, we tend to miss the more subtle signs when our dogs are feeling distressed, and that can be, you know, something as simple as them turning their head away or leaning their way or pulling their ears back and licking their lips.
Mm, so I think by that token, you think, how can we be better attuned to communicating with our dogs?
Exactly. And so I think, you know, there are a lot of really wonderful resources out there for dog lovers and dog owners to learn about how dogs communicate, and I really feel like that's a great way to deepen their relationships with their dogs. Dogs can be pretty subtle. So, you know, things that might indicate that they're feeling uncomfortable or, you know, that they don't want to interact, such as turning their head away or lip licking or yawning, aren't necessarily on our human radars. So we miss that. And then we don't recognize that the dog is feeling uncomfortable maybe until they get to the point where they're growling or showing their teeth. So I think really learning about their language can help us and clear up a lot of communication misunderstandings.
So what resources or how do you recommend that people learn more about better communicating with their dogs, not in, yeah. I guess, human language, but in dog language?
Right, in dog language. So there's a really wonderful website called Dog On Safe. That has some excellent resources, some visual resources for dog owners. There's also a really excellent YouTube video called, it's made by The Family Dog, and it's called What Your Dog is Desperately Trying to Tell You. And it's great because it shows a combination of both expressions of what we would call happiness and also expressions of, you know, discomfort or fear. So I think those would be two really good places to get people started.
What are common expressions that dogs make that humans may not be familiar with for expressions of maybe happiness or comfort?
Well, I think, you know, the happiness, I think we're actually pretty good at recognizing, and that's usually like loose body posture, you know, floppy lips with the mouth, you know, slightly open and the tail lolling out. Sometimes they even almost look like they're smiling. And then, you know, the tail wag, which is something that a lot of people will like kind of take as always a positive signal, can actually be a mixed message. So if we have a low soft tail wag, that is usually, you know, a friendly gesture. But if we have, you know, a really stiff or rapid tail wag, then that can actually just be a sign of arousal, and dogs can often, you know, be barking and growling while wagging their tail, but the intent is definitely that they're feeling distressed and aroused, and, you know, you wouldn't want to interact with a dog that was wagging its tail in that manner combined with those other signals.
That said, is it true that I saw some headlines recently about how most dogs are sad or stressed when they're being held, and we may think that maybe they're happy about it, but they're not?
Right. Right. So yeah, I mean, and I think that certainly there are plenty of dogs out there that probably enjoy physical contact with their owners, but certainly we see a lot of dogs where the owner is enjoying the interaction, but the dog is using those subtle signals like turning their head away, leaning slightly away, licking their lips, their ears are pulled back. So they're using their communication to say, I'm uncomfortable, I want this to stop. And so the best way I feel like to interact with our dogs is to, you know, pay attention to their body language during those interactions and make sure that they're enjoying it just as much as we are.
Right. Because I think when you're thinking about dogs versus cats, it's pretty clear when a cat does not want to be held, or cats are maybe a little more obvious in their communication than dogs are, I guess you would say, right?
They can be, although they have some subtle signals that they're uncomfortable too before they get to that point. But they're actually even more subtle than dogs.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Dr. Kelly Ballantyne is a veterinary behaviorist with the University of Illinois. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
That does it for this special Encore edition of The 21st. Thanks for listening. You can always find Fast Shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You want to send us an email, leave us a voicemail, follow us on social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow that for the latest Illinois news. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st. To like us, you can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. We're produced by Hala Delahi, Christine Herman, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.